Our next presentation is Preserving Chicago's Living History of Improvised Music. Now, we hear from many archives here during the conference regularly that are dealing with material that goes a ways back, but Allison Shine and Patrick Seymour are dealing with material that is goes back to, I think, just over 20 years, right? And there are already issues with this material. I'm sure there are some of you out there who wish somebody had started that close to the origin of the material in your archive to make sure it survived. Allison Shine is the Creative Audio Archive Manager, and she first got involved with the CAA in 2010 as an intern. Impressed with her work for the archives collections, including digital transfers, metadata collection, and data management, Allison was hired on to manage the archives in August 2011, from intern to manager, clawing her way to the top of the archival field. She received her master's in library and information science in August 2012 at Dominican University. Prior to her master's degree, Allison received her bachelor's at Columbia College in Chicago, studying audio arts and acoustics. When Allison is not working, she enjoys traveling the country to attend concerts, teaching kids the wonders of Chicago, and sampling small batch bourbons. Patrick Seymour, the gentleman standing there, keeps himself very busy. He's been involved with Creative Audio Archive for over a year and helped develop and launch the successful Kickstarter fundraising campaign to preserve the audio tapes of jazz and experimental sound documentarian Malachi Richer. In addition to that, he works as the archivist for photographer Steve Shapiro and as a librarian at a community college outside of Chicago and as a DJ and assistant music director at Chirp Radio. Patrick Seymour does not sleep. He grew up outside Detroit, got his bachelor's degree at Indiana University and his master's in library science at Dominican University. Patrick lives in Chicago with Amelia, his wife, and their cat, Shu. And now we'll hear from Allison and Patrick, Preserving Chicago's Living History of Improvised Music.
Hello, we're very excited to be here. Just wanted to introduce our organization to you, the creator of the collection that we're gonna talk about, our fundraising campaigns for it, and a little bit about the future preservation
plans that we have. All right.
Since you weren't close to the podium.
Thank you. A little background about our parent organization, Experimental Sound Studio. You'll see our mission. It's mostly an artist-run organization. The two ladies in the staff are not musicians, and that's probably a good thing. As you see, we try to engage in all different sorts of audio explorations. We have audio installations at the Lincoln Park Zoo in their conservatory. We do circuit bending workshops. We put on live performances. We also have an audible gallery where we have audio installations as well. Go to the next one. The Creative Audio Archive was established in 2003. The executive director and the board felt that there was no organization in Chicago that was really caring for the improvisational and experimental scene in Chicago, and they wanted to make sure that it was cared for and made available for future researchers. We currently have four multi-format collections. One is what we call our organizational archive, and that is the recordings of all our public programming, anything that we've ever done from inception to now. We have a unattended spoken word collection from Lynx Hall, and then we have a Sun Ra archive, and then we have the Malachi Richer archive, which we will talk about.
Okay. Oh. The Malachi Richer archive came to the Creative Audio Archive in 2008. He was a musician, political activist, and audio documentarian who was highly active in Chicago from the early 80s until his death in 2006. His devotion to the music and the musicians in the jazz and improvised and experimental music communities was rivaled by few in Chicago, especially in the last 10 to 15 years of his life, where he sometimes attended 4 to 5 shows a week and would often tape the shows return next week and give copies of the sets to the musicians that played in them. He was a fan of a wide variety of music, as evident by the broad range of genres in the collection. The earliest tapes were from the early 80s and caught many bands that have gone on to be regarded as important and influential acts in the underground and alternative music communities, such as Husker Du, Gang of Four, Wire, Birthday Party, ESG, and many more. But starting in the 90s, he became the personal archivist for Ken Vandermark, the saxophonist. Vandermark was already a pretty big figure in the Chicago jazz scene, playing in ensembles such as the Energy Ensemble, DKV Trio, and leading the Vandermark Five. In 1995, he received the MacArthur Genius Grant and used a portion of those fundings to help bring musicians from the European improvised music community to Chicago, which began a period of rich collaboration between the two scenes. The Malachi was also sort of at the focal point of that those collaborations and helped document a lot of it. Heavy hitters like Peter Brotzman, Paul Leighton, and then the rising stars Mats Gustafsson and Paul Nilsson Love, amongst others, collaborated heavily with Chicago musicians to form lasting ensembles and playing in one-off groups. Some of those groups never received any official recordings or released official recordings, but were documented in this collection. The music during this time represents a very fertile and creative period of Chicago jazz. Two sort of large ensembles that typify this transcontinental collaborative spirit were Peter Brotzman's Chicago Tentet, a combination of American and European free jazz players, both new and old, such as Joe McPhee, Fred Lonnberg-Holm, Mats Gustafsson, Ken Vandermark, and others. Another ensemble was a combination of two smaller groups called Atomic and School Days. They featured musicians like Vandermark again, Jeb Bishop, Magnus Brew, and Pal Nilsson Love, amongst others. The vibrant Chicago scene was also well documented. Vandermark participated in a lot of groups that featured a who's who of 90s experimental jazz musicians like Hamid Drake, Jeb Bishop, Mars Williams, Kent Kessler, amongst many others. These musicians formed a strong working network of ensembles and played with many bigger names such as Fred Anderson, as well as non-jazz musicians like Jim O'Rourke and Kevin Drum. This busy network of musicians covered a lot of ground, playing frequently, and Malachi was busy, just as busy, if not busier, recording these groups. The performances took places in venues like the beloved Lounge Acts, Chicago's Empty Bottle, which was then programming a lot of jazz festivals and experimental music nights, as well as some more impromptu house shows and short-lived performance spaces, similar to punk house venues, many of which have ceased to exist. A unique aspect about these recordings is Malachi continued to upgrade his process over the years, so the quality of recordings were good and became excellent and frequently at the professional level. In fact, some of these recordings have appeared on releases for labels like Atavistic, Oka Disc, Thrill Jockey, and others. These recordings, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, represent a snapshot of Chicago's music history. There's still a lot of really great improvised and jazz music going on, but this particular scene has long since dispersed, and the frequent appearances by international players have slowed down as well. But these tapes represent a very focused, good look at that collection, and Allison's going to talk a little bit about our preservation efforts.
I just want to point out that we got about 10 spools of CDs and DVDs, and that's what they looked like. He hadn't created a catalog as such as a spreadsheet that we got, but it made my job much easier.
He was a very thorough documentarian.
So we were faced with a funding gap, like most archives, and we were trying to figure out, do we just have a benefit? Do we have a concert? What do we do? Do we maybe go with a Kickstarter or Indiegogo? And we decided that Kickstarter would be the easiest way for us to really tap into the community that had long since wanted to hear these recordings, but it had been closed. So we decided that to go with Kickstarter. Our goal would be $5,000. We would this would kind of give us a base for preservation of DATs that we had identified as at risk. And we also wanted to kind of use this as a way to show potential future funders that we were viable and well-regarded in the community, and so that we were worth their funds and that we could definitely take this much higher than just the $5,000 that we were going to get. As you can see there, that was that is our mobile listening station. We did pop-up listening stations with various different venues within the city, and that was so they could sample what we were listening to. And as we were getting permission from artists to do this, it started to generate a lot of buzz within the music community of what we were doing. The reason why we have, well, there's a couple of, that are connected, but the reason why we have the headphone amp is because you know, these recordings are all of concerts, and concerts are a communal thing, so that way we've got four people with four headphones and that they can talk to their buddy, like, hey, did you just hear that? Which we thought was a really good way to kind of bring them out of the record store and into whatever they were listening to. So if you're familiar with Kickstarter, there's a 2 to 3 minute video that to kind of make your pitch. I did not want to be in that video at all. Didn't think that I could really sell our collection. So what we did was ask various community members and artists that had been within the collection to make our pitch for us. As far as incentives were concerned, we knew we had to give something, and potentially with, you know, from the collection, we approached two artists that kind of are on each opposite ends of the experimental jazz spectrum, so we could kind of hit everyone. It didn't matter what you liked, we had something for you. The incentives were you get one CD, you get two CDs, or you can spend a lot of money and curate a night of the archives yourself in your chosen venue. Nobody wanted to do that. The other deliverables that we have decided to do is a benefit concert, a straight concert for our Kickstarter backers. This will be a private event, special guests, and then they can also see the fruits of our labor, and they'll get firsthand to hear the music that we've transferred. We felt we set realistic goals, and we were really happy to have met them.
Okay, there was a overwhelming response. We were successfully funded within 2 weeks. Everything after that, our whole 30-day goal was just kind of gravy. A lot of positive press in national and international publications. The Wire ran a piece on it. Chicago Reader, The Examiner, Time Out Chicago, a lot of social networking. Ken Vandermark and some of the other artists were very positive and proactive with trying to get people involved via Twitter. Many of the backers, a lot of the backers were members of groups that were in the collection. And we also received a pretty generous gift, a post Kickstarter gift from his family, so they were aware of it, and they, you know, we took that as their blessing for the whole project. Kickstarter provided a lot of information. This was both our first time using Kickstarter, and they provided a lot of contact information, some of which Allison had needlessly prepped for, but it was okay because it really streamlined communication with the backers. Although one hiccup was they were restrictive in the number of surveys you can send in individual backers. And so when trying to find out who wanted which of the two CDs, we had to sort of perform some workarounds to find out that information. But we were able to update things via the actual Kickstarter page. And so we used that as open communication with our backers. With the funding, we purchased some hard drives. We also received some donations, some headphone donations. But this is a list of the equipment we've been using for our audio transfers. We initially identified all the unique recordings in the collection. A lot of the stuff had been backed up, but we had found 237 sort of master DATs that had not been backed up. We gave, for our first round of transferring, we gave priority to the 100 most that we thought were at risk. We've been transferring on two different transfer rigs. One was the control room in the experimental sound studio, and the other is sort of a more mobile rig that's in the basement near the archive. The first batch of recordings that we were able to transfer were from 1994 to 1999, and we were able to do a second batch, which was from 1999 to 2004, and that second batch was made available by...
So we were right when we said, hey, I bet if we make our goal, we'll be able to show potential funders that we're worth it. And that came through with a 30,000 one-year grant for preservation and outreach. So this way we're able to finish transferring the remaining DATs and then do a condition report and move on to cassettes. A lot of the cassettes that we've been going through now mostly center around Malachi's band and his practices. So now we're shifting from the more popular stuff to really what he was about and what he wanted to do, at least musically, which I think is really important that we make sure we have a good balance. We have finished the preservation on the first round, and now we're actively in the middle of the second round. For outreach, we've got some really great ideas to have roundtables with artists, kind of getting everybody's take in it. We want, you know, the record labels, what do they feel about it? What do the artists feel about it? What do archives, you know, what is everyone's view on it? Our next big push, so we can kind of take the collection further, is to get a permissions database. The collection has 1,500 unique recordings and multiple ensembles, so I have no idea how many we're actually gonna be able to get as far as artists are concerned. Permission and those that we cannot reach or cannot come to agreement with will remain restricted to only on-site listening. We have future partnerships with radio stations coming up. We've been approached by a couple of them. They've wanted to kind of highlight specific periods within the Chicago jazz scene, so we are definitely trying to strengthen that by letting them use, you know, samplers. So if we could kind of do it all over again, I would probably have looked into Indiegogo a little bit more, or maybe kind of modeled the Kickstarter framework and maybe just done that where, you know, you donate on our website, you do a certain amount, and you get that kind of incentive. That way we get more of the money instead of having to pay them, although paying for the streamlined communication wasn't necessarily the worst thing. We've got a couple of grant proposal ideas that didn't necessarily mesh well with certain funders, but were really great and interesting. So I wish we could have maybe incorporated that into the higher incentives as opposed to just the one higher incentive that nobody got. I would not have attempted to do an entire major online overhaul of our website prior to launching. Since the collection had been closed, the finding aid hadn't even been uploaded online at all, and DreamHost and Ruby on Rails decided not to play well about 3 weeks before we were gonna launch, which put a little kink in things, because they didn't feel that we were gonna be able to ask people for money for a collection that they had no idea what was in, aside from the artists who didn't even realize. I contacted an artist for permission, and she was like, we played 1,000 shows and never knew that there existed a recording. She was ecstatic. So that was a great way to also build awareness. And I would have plotted out our information needs better. Things like, oh, we're a 501c3, you know, nonprofit. People are gonna need tax deduction letters. That would have been helpful if the executive director kind of maybe told me that beforehand. So just stuff like that. And if someone in maybe Kickstarter land had said, hey, this is an example of all this awesome information we're gonna give you, that probably would have been a little less frustrating on my part.
Yeah, I think in conclusion, what made this project so successful is we had a really unique collection, a snapshot that had been not received a lot of documentation. We were able to identify our community and who we wanted to target it to, and we did that. I think we focused our communication with them very well. And we have a lot of great future plans, bringing partnerships, and we're going to try to continue to grow the collection and in the spirit of Malachi and continue to make this a living, breathing archive.
Yep, we're going to try and get artists within the collection to kind of give examples and maybe in the spirit of improvisation, you know, listen to a recording for about 30, 45 seconds and then pair up with another musician and just kind of run with it. So we're gonna test out, you know, at least we have the option of checking out new things without having to worry about failing too bad, because I mean, it's improv music. It's either going to be really great or just okay. Right. So thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for Allison and Patrick?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Can you talk a little bit more about access once post, you know, archival preservation, how you're going to make the stuff available? And can you talk about where you're going to be in 20 or 25 years, where this archive is going to be in 20 or 25 years?
Okay. You would like to know about access and where we're going to be in 20 or 25 years, specifically this archive.
So we are hoping that after we create this permissions database, one of a couple of things will happen. We can transfer some of the holdings to archive.org, so that way bands that already are established there, we can add to that. We are also going to try and have something like a members listening area to our website, or like a private SoundCloud where people who can't just come to. We are kind of in the north side of Chicago, not off, you know, not near any really good public transportation. So what we are trying to do is make our presence known in better venues. So we will go to, like, there's a new jazz venue that just opened up, Constellation. We're going, you know, anytime there's an artist there that's in the collection, we're gonna set up, bring their recordings and say, hey, you know, listen, check this out. So we're branching out, you know, within the city, wherever we can, to say, hey, you know, we get it, you can't come and listen, but we're gonna set up open shop here, bring your headphones. Use our headphones, you know. And then we're also contracting with a web developer to make our finding aid so they can tag it and make help us make corrections. While he was very detailed, his penmanship wasn't always the best. So that way, you know, they can make corrections, well, they can leave comments so we can then later make easy corrections. In 20 years, it would be great if the entire archive has a couple more collections that we're trying to chase that would fit really well. And I would like to see reference copies absolutely somewhere stored online, whether it's the cloud, archive.org, some kind of repository where anyone can listen, since not a lot of the musicians even know that these recordings exist. So then that way we can just, you know, provide them with one if they want.
Yeah.
They could, once they figure out their restructuring deal.
Yes.
And one of the things we're contacting artists with is, when asking permissions, we're using sort of a Creative Commons level of
licensing.
So, you know, if they want to let us, we're asking if we can play this on the radio, if we can make it available commercially, if we can make it available for online or downloading. So that sort of level of permission database.
And since we have an established relationship with OkaDisc, Bruno Johnson is actually sort of how we got the collection, and we are also exploring what we can do to commercially release some of it and see, you know, what kind of split we can do with that.
We have another question back there.
Does your lab digitize materials from outside of the collection?
Is what?
Does your lab digitize materials from outside of the collection?
We do.
Is that offered as a service if somebody wanted to contact you?
Yes. If you go to the last screen, you can contact me, and anyone who, we can definitely send out a proposal for anyone who's got any digitization work they need.
All right. Got a handful of recordings from Jeb Bishop and Tim Daisy, as well as Jeff Parker and Chris Lopes. Is there any chance to add specific collection level of these performers? Are you trying to keep it at the collection level of Malachi, or are you trying to break it down to performer level?
We have the performers on there, but that would be really too hard to do from all the different ensembles. There's just no way that we could probably do that, unfortunately.
Well, I'll be willing to share my recordings of those guys if you want them.
That would be fantastic.
And if you like the way Malachi labeled his disc, you'll appreciate mine as well. So
fantastic. That would be great.